It's the State Capitol Report on the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward. It's a busy time in the State House as lawmakers work to move forward a wide range of legislation and finalize the state's budget. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Wisconsin Public Radio's Sean Johnson is Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I want to talk a little bit about the budget. It's supposed to take effect this weekend if it's finished by then, but Governor Evers is threatening to veto this over the DEI stuff. Can you explain that? And what happens if the budget remains unsigned on July 1st?
So as far as what happens if the budget remains unsigned on July 1st, it's sort of anticlimactic. In Wisconsin, the way that it works here is if you don't have a new budget in effect by that day, the old budget just rolls over into the next year. And so spending will continue at last budget's level. So you don't get a situation like you do in some other states where, you know, they basically just don't know what to do when they hit a certain deadline. We're not at that in Wisconsin.
Okay. So we don't have this drop dead date that where the state just can't operate.
Yeah. You definitely don't hear. They have recently operated in Wisconsin, like it is kind of a drop dead date to them, but it's just the way that the legislature has worked here. If you look at the last couple budgets, the governor signed them in, you know, early July. So we're kind of on track for that right now. So the second part of your question, though, about the veto, you know, if the governor were to take that step and veto the budget outright, that'd be, you know, that would make for an interesting summer and year in terms of like what would happen next with, you know, the governor and the legislature and, you know, any kind of standoff between the two. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, if you just look historically at whether governors veto budgets outright, they just don't, because they have this powerful partial veto pen in Wisconsin that once the budget gets to them, they can rework it in ways that make it more palatable. Gets a little tricky with certain areas of the budget because there's just, I think the general rule that you'd say is that they can't veto money back in to the budget. They can strike stuff out. They can kind of creatively reconfigure words to change the meaning of the budget in some places. But, you know, with like that $32 million actual cut to the University of Wisconsin system, it's a little tricky. I'm not sure exactly how the governor would restore that money. Although there are very creative people that work in budget offices, it seems like this is their time of year to shine.
Yeah. How common is it for Wisconsin to experience a state budget delay? Is this something that happens frequently?
Yeah. I mean, like in Wisconsin recently, they've been just on a clock where once they get around this time of year, they hurry up and pass it. The last time we had a late budget was the last budget under former Governor Scott Walker, where he and Republicans just weren't seeing eye to eye on a lot of stuff. The last really, really late budget we had was under, you know, back in 2007, when you had actually Republicans and Democrats split in the legislature and they went until October. When things get kind of crazy because you have school funding deadlines at that point, which are actually kind of serious, where schools need to know how much money they're going to get or they can't basically operate. We're not there yet. I don't think there's any signs that we're going to be there. You know, it could be that this just turns out you're going to have a busy week this week. It's going to be kind of chaotic in the legislature. And then it goes to the governor, and it could be that it kind of ends up an early July signing like we've seen in recent years with some changes from the governor.
Oh, yeah, I remember that from way back then. Now that you mention it, I had forgotten about that. Let's talk.
That was a long summer.
Oh, yeah, it was. It was. Let's talk a little bit about tax cuts. Wisconsin Republicans passed a plan to cut income taxes by about 15%. Democrats say the cut will mostly benefit the wealthy. Saw a report this morning that showed that I think you have to make more than $70,000 a year for it to make that target. Governor Evers previously proposed a tax cut primarily benefiting low-income and middle-class Wisconsinites. What are the key differences between the two proposals? What are we seeing?
Yeah, the governor's plan was targeted at people, at individuals who earn less than $100,000 and married couples who earn less than $150,000. You know, it was structured in part with you know, like tax credits to get the job done. The Republican tax cut that they passed out of committee last week, that they'll probably pass out of the full legislature this week, was it would cut every income tax bracket that we have here in Wisconsin, including the top bracket, the bracket for you know, wealthiest taxpayers in Wisconsin, which is noteworthy because that is something that they have, even in all their years of control under, you know, former Governor Scott Walker, under their first couple budgets under Governor Evers, they have basically left that top bracket alone and not taken the step of saying, let's, you know, cut taxes for the wealthy. In this case, they would cut every bracket. And, you know, it's an average tax cut of 15% across all the brackets. If you're looking in actual dollar terms, though, you know, the more you earn, the larger the tax cut is going to be, you know, as a percentage. So it's something we haven't seen here in Wisconsin. Democrats added that that top bracket, or increased that top bracket, back in the budget ahead of the Great Recession. So it's been around a while now. And, you know, if this were to go through, it'd be a substantial change and kind of a move toward a flat tax in Wisconsin. Although this is one where I think the governor's partial veto pen could definitely come into play. You know, he could just potentially accept the rest of the tax cut, strike that top bracket, and, you know, the state would just have about $465 million sitting in the general fund if he went that route.
We're talking about state politics with WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. Earlier this month, Governor Evers signed a shared revenue deal into law, and that will increase state funding to all Wisconsin municipalities by about 20%, by at least 20%, I should say. So what programs or institutions are going to be benefiting most from this funding boost?
With that one, that's going to be pretty much anything that you rely on from, I shouldn't say anything, but a lot of the programs that you rely on from your city government or your county government. So police, ambulance, roads, court costs, those are the kinds of things that that shared revenue increase can go toward. And it's, you know, you have a floor of how much people are going to get, but some smaller towns are going to get a pretty sizable percentage increase. And then, like in the city of Milwaukee, it hasn't happened yet, but if the common council there and the county board there approve it, they're going to have a potentially a 2% sales tax increase in Milwaukee and a 0.4% sales tax increase in the county of Milwaukee. So, you know, the biggest thing that they're going to notice there is, you know, there's not going to be massive cuts of like hundreds of police and closing libraries all over the city, stuff like that. If that comes to pass, that's not a done deal, but I think the Milwaukee element of that plan is, I don't think it can be overstated. It's pretty big.
Sean Johnson is WPR Capital Bureau Chief. This is the State Capital Report. You can call in to 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward. We're continuing our discussion about the decisions lawmakers are making in Madison. Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sean Johnson, WPR Capitol Bureau Chief, stays with us. Let's circle back to the DEI issue. Republicans voted yes on a budget cut for the University of Wisconsin, a sum of $32 million. It targets diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts in the university. As we discussed earlier, Tony Evers said that he would veto any bill that contained this kind of cut. So do you expect pushback from state Democrats if Evers does not sign the state budget by July 1st from Democrats?
I think you're going to see a lot of pushback from Democratic lawmakers in the legislature because, I mean, they're not in the position that Evers is. first of all, he's a statewide office holder, of course, and you know he's just got a different political calculus than they do. But he also gets to rework the budget a bit with his veto pen. And so what he ends up proving if he does that would be a little bit different than what comes out of the legislature this week. So I think you're going to hear a lot of Democrats unhappy with this budget. The cut to the University of Wisconsin system is noteworthy because, I mean, one, we're getting into a very hot button cultural issue here. And Republicans seem very eager to wade into it with cutting funding and specifying that it's for diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts at the University of Wisconsin system. Just from a financial perspective, the state has a $7 billion surplus. I've never seen a surplus like that. So to have an actual state funding cut to the UW is, that's noteworthy.
Actually, we have a caller who has a question about the surplus. It's John with us now. Hello, John. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm thinking about the famous economists of our history books, like Stuart Mills and Mr. Keynes from England. Now, we have, according to everybody who's reporting from the bank, $7 billion of surplus. Is that in gold bars? Or how do we collect interest on that?
Huh. Okay. Thanks, John. How do we collect interest on that surplus? Do you know?
So the $7 billion is a projected number. It's basically, just think of it like the state's checkbook. It's the general fund. It is what the legislature's budget office says, you know, based on everything we're seeing with the way that taxes are coming in, the way that spending is going out, looks like on June 30th, at the end of this budget, we're going to have, I think the number is like $6.9 billion now, according to their latest estimate. So I think $7 billion is still a fair weight around it. And, that is basically, that's the baseline that lawmakers and the governor use to build the budget for the next time. They can spend that down. They can, they can sock it away. They can put it into tax cuts, schools. That's kind of what's driving the decisions. As you can see, I mean, the governor's budget would have put a substantially larger part of it in public schools. He would have put more of it in, the UW, other stuff like childcare, broadband. Republicans have prioritized in a big way tax cuts. It's not a surprise exactly, but as you look at the budget big picture here, and they have a $3.5 billion income tax cut, that is what they decided to do with the surplus.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the tech college. I want to shift gears here just a little bit. The state technical college system is the subject of a bill that's moving through the legislature. There's an amendment that was made to the bill that would keep tech colleges from spending property taxes on operations. Ways and Means Committee Chair Rep. John Mocco was listed as the author of the proposal, but WPR requested documents and found that Assembly Speaker Robin Voss had requested the amendment. Why does it matter who wrote or requested this amendment?
I think that when you see Speaker Voss putting his name on something like that, that's a choice. That is him saying, hey, this is something that we'd like to do here potentially. And it could be a way of sending a message to the technical college system. It could be a way of trying to push it through his caucus, but it's a substantial change. I mean, it's basically, I think you could frame it in different ways. It does take away the power of technical colleges to levy local property taxes. By doing that, it takes away that local control. I mean, it would have a huge state investment that would go along with it, but the state would kind of run the technical colleges in Wisconsin. It would be the state's higher ed system in a big way. And so this is something that Speaker Voss was interested in. Last week, when it came up for a vote in the assembly, they decided not to pass it. And I don't think there's any plans to move that forward
No.
now.
Okay.
But it's something that, you know, our colleague Rich Kramer uncovered that the speaker was looking into. I think anytime the speaker is looking into something in the legislature, that's significant because he's the, you know, most powerful lawmaker there.
That's so interesting. We're talking about state politics with WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. Childcare costs are so high for people. I mean, we talk about this all the time. And Republicans voted to defund childcare counts. That's a COVID-era childcare subsidy program. It's expected to run out of state funding by February. Can the program survive without it?
The childcare counts will, you know, barring some action from the state or from the federal government, that program will run out of money in February. And so there are other, you know, state programs that are designed to make childcare more affordable for people with lower incomes. But this particular subsidy, where the governor wanted to spend $340 million and Republicans countered with zero, is, you know, likely set to go away. Mm-hmm. And I think you're going to hear a lot about that if that's the end result here, because there are childcare centers who have said that that was part of their business model, basically. If you look at what employees of childcare centers are making and what they could make in other fields, it's a challenge for them to retain people. If they don't have people, they can't take in new kids. If they can't take in new kids, then parents are struggling with, well, what do I do for my child care? And, you know, the Republicans have said that they want to pass legislation at some point this session dealing with the child care crisis. But Speaker Voss has said that he does not think that taxpayers should subsidize it. So, you know, that... Mm-hmm. That's where you get that kind of chasm between the governor and Republicans, where he wants to spend $340 million on this program. They want to spend zero. It's a significant difference.
Yeah.
And there's some real problems in the child care system that could come to light here in a big way over the next couple of years.
Well, and when we talk about K-12 funding, Wisconsin Republicans passed a proposal to increase K-12 spending by $1 billion. It's less than half of what Governor Evers requested. Again, a big difference here. So put those numbers into context for us. Is a $1 billion increase across the state going to make a significant impact on public education? What are your thoughts on that?
So it is about, I think with this one, it's important to point out that the governor is in on that deal. I mean, this is the $1 billion number is a deal that he did cut with Republicans.
Okay.
And, you know, while he proposed roughly, you know, $2.8 billion in his budget that he proposed to the legislature earlier this year, that's always kind of a starting point in negotiations. And he knew he wasn't going to get that exact number from this legislature. So he was celebrating the $1 billion. They were celebrating the $1 billion. I think you would talk to schools in around the state, and depending on their situations, some of them will be happy. Some of them will say, hey, that's not enough. But it's a larger increase than they've seen in recent budgets. And there is a per pupil increase in each year of the budget that's larger than the state's seen recently. So, you know, it's significant. Smaller than what the governor wanted, but it's significant compared to recent budgets.
And finally, I just want to touch on broadband in the last minute we have together. Republicans cut Evers' broadband budget proposal. They want to wait for the possibility of federal funding. It came out this morning that the Biden administration plans to roll out some federal funding for broadband. So is the federal funding going to be the thing that we're waiting for with broadband that will finally bring broadband to all Wisconsinites?
That is definitely what Republicans said they're waiting for here. You know, on some budget issues, it's like hard to parse it out. There's just small differences, or you got to qualify the differences. On broadband, it's another one of those where it's pretty easy to explain. The governor proposed spending $750 million in state funding on broadband. Republicans just zeroed that out. And they said that this round of broadband funding, which I think is going to be announced on Friday, is what they are you know, pinning their hopes on. It's going to be, I think, for Wisconsin, the Public Service Commission said it'd be between $700 million and $1.1 billion for Wisconsin in federal broadband funding. So that's, I mean, that's a huge amount of money for broadband. The Evers administration just said, look, if we really want to build out broadband everywhere, we need this state component too.
Thank you so much for being here today and sharing all this information with us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Shereen.
Sean Johnson, WPR Capital Bureau Chief. This is the State Capital Report. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer-Kent. PFAS have been making headlines for months in Wisconsin and beyond, but what exactly are they? The Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry explains PFAS this way, as man-made chemicals that have been used in consumer products and industry since the 40s. For years, PFAS were used to make nonstick cookware, stain-resistant fabrics and carpets, firefighting foams, lots of other products that resist grease, water, and oil. But they don't break down in nature. And emerging research suggests significant health effects from exposure to PFAS, which can build up in the human body over time. So in Wisconsin, lawmakers are continuing their debate on how best to deal with the issue. So what would you like to know? You can call us, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We have two members of the PFAS Project Lab out of Northeastern University. The lab studies the social, scientific, and political factors of PFAS on a national level. Phil Brown is the co-director of the lab, directs the Social Science Environmental Health Research Institute. Phil, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi there.
Kimberly Garrett is also a member and environmental health scientist and toxicologist. Kimberly, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Last month, Wisconsin Republicans crafted a bill that would address PFAS contamination. So during public hearings this month, the bill drew some support, some opposition in both the state assembly and the state senate. Phil, what's your reaction to this legislation?
Well, we've been following a lot of legislation for a number of years, and I have to say this is the oddest one. Most of the legislation these days is banning one or more uses of PFAS, putting out health advisories, putting out regulatory limits, which we call maximum contaminant levels. And this bill is simply putting forth some money to test water and to provide some remediation. So it's the most limited bill that we have seen. And especially at a time when states are being much more aggressive in banning and regulating many types of PFAS.
Then the Washington Post reports that 24 states are actively banning or restricting PFAS. How urgent is the need to address this across the country? Kimberly, I'll go to you on this.
Great. So it's a really, really urgent environmental issue. PFAS chemicals last a really long time in the environment, and they can bioaccumulate. And up until this point, they've been allowed to be released into the environment with very little regulation. And so this is quite an urgent issue.
We're talking about proposals by Republican lawmakers on cleaning up PFAS contamination in Wisconsin. We get some perspective from the PFAS Project Lab out of Northeastern University. We have Phil Brown and Kimberly Garrett with us. Kimberly, Wisconsin's latest bill would limit the authority of the State Department of Natural Resources to test for PFAS and require remediation. How significant are state agencies, what their role in combating PFAS across the country?
Well, so far, without sweeping federal regulation, like the contamination level or the maximum contaminant levels proposed by EPA, testing and remediation has been left up to states. And so state agencies have been really essential in our start to fight PFAS contamination. And this bill really seems to limit Wisconsin's state agency with limitations that are far more restrictive than any other bill that we've seen.
And Kim, what do you think is behind that? I mean, why are we seeing that here in Wisconsin, that the kind of resistance to testing?
I imagine that it's a lot of pressure from private property owners, perhaps industry, because we know that industrial facilities account for a large portion of PFAS contamination, and there's a lot of resistance to having that made public.
So, Phil, what's your reaction to limiting the Department of Natural Resources' ability to test and require remediation?
I think it's a terrible thing. Here in Massachusetts, where I live and I work, we've seen our state agency, the Department of Environmental Protection, do so much. We were one of the first states to regulate PFAS chemicals. When EPA was testing medium and large size water systems, our state agency went in there and said, you know, we're going to test smaller systems too, because we think they might have contamination. They also did a whole project on testing private drinking wells, which is not anything that's tested by EPA, and there are never any regulations on private wells. So a state agency can really have a lot of authority and a lot of initiative to do very good things. And it's been very helpful here. It's been very helpful in other states as well.
Kimberly, the EPA hasn't come down with a federal limit. When do you think that's going to happen? And what do you think that limit will be?
So they say that they're coming down at the end of the year. And we saw last year that they released near zero proposed limits, but then they walked that back a little bit due to available technology and our capacity to filter PFAS out of water. But I hope by the end of the year. And I believe it's 4 parts per trillion. Is that correct? I don't have my notes.
That's okay.
Out, but
Phil, what do you think about the EPA coming down with a national limit? Do you think that will take some of the argument away from, there are people who think that this is all unnecessary. So, I mean, will that just kind of even the playing field for states?
Well, obviously when EPA finalizes these regulations, that will be a very important thing, and it will keep states from having higher levels. So right now you have states that do have higher levels. And, you know, it's a benefit to them because they don't have to go out and do all of the research and do all the hearings and go through all of the work and also deal with industry suits sometimes against them when they produce these MCLs. So yes, it would be very helpful, but that doesn't mean that the state agencies still won't have roles, because the states can still do a lot of other testing, as I mentioned before, private drinking wells. They can put large amounts of money in for remediation processes. They can continue to do research that will include more of the PFAS compounds in, because right now there's a limited number, only 6 that are being proposed for regulation. And there's no state that has more than 6. Some states have 2 or 3, some have 4 or 5, but very few have even as many as 6. So yes, this will be a very big benefit and will help the states, many of whom don't have enough staff and laboratory facilities to do the kind of research that is needed to put forth MCLs or any other kind of regulations.
Phil, the Wisconsin bill would provide grants to help municipalities test for PFAS and pay for related infrastructure upgrades for remediation, but doesn't include funding for other programs like, well, I don't know. I mean, what are some of the other states doing to help support municipalities financially with this?
Well, that part is what's good, that they are providing that. Our bill that we're seeing in Massachusetts that we've just testified, both Kimberly and I testified, along with a number of other colleagues just last week, includes many regulations, many bans on dozen uses of PFAS in rugs and carpets and food packaging, as well as providing a lot of funding. But to provide funding alone is just not sufficient. And some of the amounts we saw in there are very low, and they don't strike me as being feasible to help communities do this work.
So if money isn't enough, what more besides money do they need to do, Phil?
Well, you know, there are 23 states where the attorneys general have filed suit asking that the court find the companies liable for this. So this is what we call make the polluter pay. That's an important thing to do. I think the state should be able to sign on to that and do things of that sort. There's a national suit that's been consolidated in South Carolina around firefighting foam, AFFF. So there are things that could be done to make the manufacturers and the remanufacturers, the ones who use PFAS chemicals, like in the production of nonstick cookware or stain-resistant fabrics. All of these people knew the risks, they knew the hazards, they knew the liabilities, and they still went ahead and did it. So making the polluters pay for these multi-billion dollar cleanups and remediation is very important.
You know, Kimberly, building on what Phil said, thinking about how polluters are held accountable, how difficult is it to hold polluters accountable, especially if you have, let's say you have a manufacturing community and you have, you know, three or four manufacturers? How do you identify which company is responsible for that?
Well, up until this point, it's been very, very difficult. We have historic success cases like Parkersville, West Virginia, Parkersburg, West Virginia, sorry, was one of the first lawsuits brought against a PFAS manufacturer by an impacted community. And since then, we've only seen the number of lawsuits increase, including some by states this year. It can be very difficult because companies are allowed to keep their formulas secret as confidential business information. And as there are currently over 14,000 chemicals that could be considered PFAS and not necessarily all in use, but there is a wide variety and it can be kind of difficult to fingerprint what blends of PFAS are used and where they end up in the environment.
And the proposed bill would focus on remediation of PFAS. How should state lawmakers balance cleaning up and banning its future use? Phil, I'll go to you.
Well, with any kind of toxic chemical, you always want to cut it off at the faucet. So you want to go as far upstream as you can and stop it from happening, because otherwise the amazingly large number of uses of PFAS that we're finding out more and more about every day are just inundating us. And until we stop that, we won't be able to keep them out of the environment and out of people's bodies. Day by day, we see PFAS found in plastics and pesticides. We're finding them in personal care products, in pharmaceuticals, in medical devices. We're finding them in artificial turf. And it's almost like every week you see another major study that shows how broad PFAS are throughout the environment. So you've got to cut it off. That's why the bills to ban the use of chemicals is so important, because that stops it at the source.
We have Kimberly Garrett and Phil Brown here with us today from the PFAS Project Lab out of Northeastern University. This is the State Capitol Report. Call in 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward, continuing our discussion on PFAS remediation and regulation in Wisconsin. Call in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have scientists Bill Brown and Kimberly Garrett with us. They are members of the PFAS Project Lab out of Northeastern University. The lab studies the social, scientific, and political factors of PFAS on a national level. They both stay with us. Jane is on the phone with us from Suwamish. Go with a question. Hello, Jane. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I have two things I'd like to have them talk about. Mm-hmm. One is PFAS is being found now in the Bay of Green Bay, and Green Bay has the largest freshwater estuary in the world, and there are grants being assigned to it to study it and protect it. And I'm wondering if they know anything about PFAS being monitored there and what might happen there. And then the other part is the state of Wisconsin is very rural, so we have many private wells instead of wastewater treatment facilities for municipalities. And I understand that deep drilling is being used to give people fresh or clean water, non-contaminated water, but that is causing a drawdown into the earth of the higher level contaminated PFAS water.
Okay. All right. Two-part question then. Thank you, Jane, so much. Phil, do you know anything about the Green Bay situation with the contamination there, or is that something that's not on your radar?
This is something we've heard about, but we're not expert on that. There are people who really do specialize a lot in PFAS and fish. We do know that there are a lot of places, both fresh water and salt water, that are highly contaminated in fish with very, very high exposure. And a lot of places where there's, in fact, warnings against eating fish because of that. And similarly for other wildlife, for game. So we know that this is an issue, and more testing is obviously necessary all the time. And when necessary, fish advisories in multiple languages and also very well posted, because often you see fish advisories that are posted only in English and very sparsely distributed around a place where people are fishing. So it's not surprising that you would find it in any large freshwater area.
Okay. Jane also asked about private wells and deep drilling. Kimberly, what about those private wells and deep drilling? Is that making things worse or better?
So up until this point, as I mentioned, without federal support, private well testing has come to the responsibility of states. And so that's why state funding would be really, really important to address this issue. As for the drawdown issues, we've seen this with other environmental contaminants, and drilling deeper is a temporary solution, but it can cause issues in the surrounding environment and is really a reminder of how connected our environmental systems are to each other and how we have to be very careful from the start. But I'm not familiar with the specifics of drawdown for PFAS chemicals.
Okay. We'll go to the phone again with Steve now from Sun Prairie. Steve is with us. Good morning.
Morning. I know the guests were talking about holding manufacturers accountable for different types of pollution and things like that. Wondering what the guests feel should be done to, let's say, the city of Milwaukee, who actively pumps raw sewage into Lake Michigan when their sanitation departments get overrun. Should people be personally, government officials, personally liable for those decisions?
That's an interesting question. Thank you, Steve. Phil, what do you think about that? Should officials be held personally liable for these decisions?
Well, we certainly saw that in Detroit with the lead contamination crisis, where the officials really knew what the problem was and covered it up. And we've seen this in a lot of other places as well. So yes, they should be held responsible. But obviously, you've got to understand that many cities and towns don't yet know the extent of the problem. So we're seeing in some states, for instance, there are requirements to test all the wastewater effluents. And there are requirements to test the sludge that's coming out of wastewater treatment plants, because that's been a very big source of PFAS, and that's wound up in a lot of the food that we eat. And we've seen large and small dairies alike in multiple states have to shut down because their cows have eaten sludge fertilized grass, and then that's wound up in the milk. So yes, the problem is a combination of responsibility for the public, officials and agencies, but also for the manufacturers. But more knowledge, more treatment, more monitoring potential for all of those sites is what we need.
We're talking
about, obviously, it's not good to dump untreated waste into rivers. You've got to find lots of other approaches, combine sewer outflows and other approaches.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation down in Milwaukee. We're talking about PFAS contamination with the PFAS Project Lab out of Northeastern University. Phil Brown and Kimberly Garrett stay with us. When we're talking about holding manufacturers accountable, I want to mention that last week, Chemical manufacturer 3M reached an agreement to pay at least $10.3 billion to settle lawsuits over contamination of U.S. public drinking water systems. This agreement involves about 300 communities, including some in Wisconsin. Not sure what the impact for Wausau is yet, but there is a Wausau plant. Phil, what's your reaction to the settlement? Is $10.3 billion enough?
It's not enough. I mean, obviously, it is a very, very large settlement. And we're going to see more settlements like this. This is not the first case that 3M has lost. We've certainly seen it with DuPont, as Kimberly mentioned before, in the Parkersburg, West Virginia case, which was really the biggest wake-up call we saw and also spurred the judge to order a very large health study, which is the first time that we really knew with publicly accessible information how many health effects there were attributable to one specific PFAS chemical, PFOA. So, yeah, this is an important suit. Or the other suits in progress, some of which are set by individuals, some of which the plaintiffs are attorneys general, some of which are individual states. More and more of this is necessary. It's not enough because these treatment plants, the filtration plants, are expensive to put up. They have a very large annual maintenance cost, and we've got to find ways to dispose of all of the toxics once they're taken out and put into whatever system, such as granular activated carbon.
Kimberly, under the latest bill, the state DNR is prohibited from requiring the testing of PFAS at abandoned or idle industrial sites. What is the relationship between PFAS and industrial sites in a nutshell?
So there are certain industries that can be closely related to PFAS use, and we can say that they are presumed to have PFAS contamination. And so without the ability to go in and actually test for that, it's very difficult to understand the full picture of PFAS contamination. And so certain industries certainly have PFAS contamination, specifically through historic use before we had any kind of regulation against their release.
Lisa from Amberg called. She wants to know if we can hold companies responsible for PFAS in the same way we did with tobacco. Phil, do you think this is going to turn into something like the tobacco thing? And we only have about 30 seconds left together in our time, but I wanted to address that.
I think so. What's also interesting is the corporations have been using some of the same public relations firms that did the tobacco work. And they're, you know, trying to find ways to keep this from happening. But yes, I mean, the example before I gave of the consolidated suit in South Carolina, this is an example where you're going to have very large national level cases with huge amounts then being distributed to states to do the work, usually as they see fit.
All right.
I think it's going to
I'm so sorry I have to cut you off there. We've got to go. But thank you so much for joining us. This has been fascinating, and I'm sorry we couldn't get to all the calls. Phil Brown and Kimberly Garrett, our guests today. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Shereen Seewert. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.